Good morning, everyone. I'd like to bring the Tuesday, March 26th meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. A little orientation for the week for members and the public. We've got a lot of work to do, and we're going to be doing it. But that'll require a couple of things. We've got time limits for targets for all of the bills. I believe those are on the public agenda. So ask everyone, out of respect for the other bill authors, the other bills, the other advocates who are here, to please stay to those time limits as to allow us to consider all of the requests before the committee and all the issues before our schools and students. It will also mean a couple of evening meetings, Wednesday and Thursday evening of this week. I recognize for members that this is not the only committee that will be meeting these evenings. I know I will have a couple of times where I'll have to leave the committee to present bills in other settings. So ask members to let us know where you are. I don't anticipate many votes at this point, but it's nice to know where you are in case we need to bring you back, or in case you're one of the authors with a bill before the committee and we want to get you here so the committee can keep moving along quickly. I think that's it. All right. Welcome to the new week, everyone. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to share some information with you and the committee in regard to Representative Kreisha's frequent absences this session. He has dealt with a mother and father who have had a crushing blow to them in that one of their daughters, Representative Kreisha's sister, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And when you have parents and they're losing a child, that becomes very, you know, it can become traumatic for them. And so he has had many visits to them to comfort them, to help them visit the dying daughter, Representative Kreisha's sister, and she did die Thursday evening. So he is gone from us for a few days to pay his respects to her and the family, and hopes to return Thursday night or Friday. So I just wanted the committee to know that we need to think of him in our thoughts and prayers as he goes through this.
Representative Erickson, thank you for that, and thank you for sharing it so that the community here knows that. I remember many years ago, being with random chance, being with my grandmother, the day we learned that one of my aunts, one of her daughters, died. And although my grandmother was quite elderly at the time, and her daughter had lived a decent age, it was still a significant blow when kind of the natural order of things that we expect is violated. So I'll extend my own condolences and to Representative Kreisha and his family. And I'm sure that the committee does hold them in their thoughts and prayers as well. So thank you for sharing that. With that, Representative Kunesh-Podein, you are up first. You want us to do the minutes? Sure. Would you be so good as to move the minutes, Representative Kunesh-Podein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love to approve the minutes from, what was that day? March 21st, 2019.
March 21st. Excellent. Any discussion to the Kunesh-Podein motion? Hearing none, Representative Kunesh-Podein moves the March 21st minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Kunesh-Podein. Would you like to move House File 824 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in a future division report?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And Representative Kunesh-Podein, you have an author's amendment. Is that the A190233 amendment?
I believe it is.
And that's to get the bill in the form
order
you
it needs to be.
Prefer. All right.
Thank
With
you.
That, Representative Kunesh-Podein moves the A190233 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Kunesh-Podein, your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am really excited to share this 2019 Increased Teachers of Color Act House File 824 with you. And I'm really especially grateful for the strong bipartisan support that this bill has received, including those members here that have signed on as co-authors. So a fun fact about House File 824, it is among the top two bills referred to this committee in terms of total of number of authors and the degree of bipartisanship. So we're really proud of the hard work that so many folks have done on this. I'm also grateful for the consensus of support for this comprehensive bill with nearly 50 very different stakeholder organizations with differing views on legislation. They are all listed as endorsers of this bill, and they're on the back of this sheet right here. You'll see a list of them. They have provided a lot of support to the coalition to increase teachers of color as well. So, colleagues, under the leadership of both parties, our state has been working for over more than two decades to address the persistent achievement gap and the severe shortage of teachers of color. And up to now, our state has only funded relatively few but very good pieces of legislatures and small programs to help our teachers of color while expecting really serious systemic results. And in metaphorical terms, the relative crumbs appropriated in each of the past 20 years haven't fed Minnesota's children who have been starving for teachers who reflect their own diversity. The research is clear that when teachers of color are in the classroom, we narrow the achievement and the discipline gaps, and all students benefit. But these gaps remain wide in Minnesota, in part because we have not systematically addressed this increasing opportunity gap where all students lack equitable access to diverse teachers. This comprehensive, carefully crafted bill of interconnected programs begins with scholarships. It includes grants to ease the financial burden of student teaching and to include the support of mentorship in efforts to retain our teachers of color and indigenous teachers. This bill is a historic, serious investment because for the first time in our state and in the country, there is a proposed piece of legislation for systems change that would finally move the needle and start increasing the percentage of teachers of color and indigenous teachers above just 4%. The dozen appropriations in this bill are not an inflated wish list or a menu from which to pick and choose from. They are the minimum investments that we need if we want to have and expect different results. So in your purple folder, you'll find a two-sided sheet that compares the details, and it's this one, about the proposed investments and the impact of this bill with the governor's budget and current spending. At this time, I would like to turn the microphones over to our stakeholders so that you can hear from them. You're going to hear first from the ethnic councils and then from students, teacher candidates, and teachers yourself. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And given the time limits for the bill that were communicated to the author previously and the number of testifiers, each testifier will have about 2 minutes. Who's up first? Please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Melanie Franks from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council.
My name is Jasmine Carey for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage.
People could work one at a time. So introduce yourself, proceed with your testimony, then move on to the next person. I think it'll be clearer for the tape.
Okay.
Thank you.
Melanie Franks with the Indian Affairs Council. Chair and members, as state agencies, we have an important statutory role to advise and inform elected officials about our constituent communities and their needs. Students from our communities currently represent 34% of all students in Minnesota, which is an increase from 24% just a decade ago. Meanwhile, the percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers in the state has remained at a stagnant 4% over that same decade, and this severe shortage is one of the main reasons we continue to have this some of the nation's worst achievement gaps. We thank you for hearing this important bill that will help narrow these gaps.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Jasmine Carey from the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. Chair and members, in 2016, state laws amended several statutes asserting that all students shall have improved and equitable access to effective and diverse teachers who reflect the diversity of students in their schools. For reference, there is a handout in your packet which lists the percentage of students of color and American Indians in every school district that members of this committee represent. To further highlight the severe shortage statewide, please consider that if all students had equitable access to diverse teachers now, Minnesota would have 18,506 more teachers of color and American Indian teachers than the 2,745 who are currently teaching full-time.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Katie Sai from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Addressing the severe shortage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers has been a top priority in education for our four councils over the past biennium and the current session. The comprehensive set of policy proposals and strategic investments in House File 824 will attract, prepare, and retain significantly more diverse teachers and finally start increasing their percentage in the state. Recently, the Education Policy Committee took historic action and included all proposed amendments to existing statutes in their omnibus bill, House File 1711. We strongly recommend that you also fully support for possible inclusion in your division report all 12 of the interconnected proposed investments for further strengthening existing programs and establishing important new programs in this historic bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Chair members, for the record, my name is Violeta Hernandez Espinosa, and I represent the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Chair members, please know that this carefully crafted bill is based on feedback from hundreds of educators and others from our communities over the past 2 years. It is also the result of several drafts being vetted over several months prior to session by our councils and a wide variety of education organizations that has resulted in consensus and nearly 50 organizational endorsements. Therefore, we ask that you please continue to consult with our councils and the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota during the development of your division report and further negotiations. We can help you ensure that investment decisions will have the most impact to address the severe and persistent shortage of racially and ethnically diverse teachers that our students need. We thank you for your leadership on this issue and your time.
Thank you all very much. By my list, next up would be Chi Vang and Sherry Zhang. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Chi Vang. Chair and members, good morning. My name is Chi Vang. I am a senior at Washington Technology Magnet School in St. Paul. At Washington, we offer dual credit concurrent enrollment programs through the University of Minnesota and St. Paul College. I have taken several of these courses and will be graduating with 22 college credits from the University of Minnesota. One class was called Exploring the Teaching Profession. In this class, we talked about a lot of different topics. We talked about student motivation, how the purposes of schools have changed over time, how to work with challenging students, and why teachers are extremely important. In the service learning portion of this class, I worked in an eighth grade algebra support class. I assisted the teacher, observed in the classroom, and worked on one-on-one with the eighth graders. I was worried at first because I honestly didn't think I could handle eighth graders, but of course, I worried for nothing. The eighth graders, though loud and too energetic, are good students. They respected me as someone older than them and as their tutor. They paid attention whenever I was tutoring them, even if they got distracted here and there. I am grateful and thankful that I had the opportunity to take this class. This class has given me the ability to understand others more. I have certainly grown a lot, not just as a student, but also as a young aspiring teacher. I have seen the importance of helping students learn and grow. I started this class wanting to get college credits and community service hours. Because of my experiences, I have realized that I want to become a teacher. My dream is to be a middle school math teacher for the St. Paul Public Schools. Taking this class has changed my life, and I hope more students in St. Paul Public Schools and the whole state will have opportunities like this if you increase funding for them. I also hope you fully fund the scholarship programs proposed in this bill to help me and other future teachers of color earn our degree and license. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Vang. Ms. Zhang.
Chairs and members, good morning. My name is Sherry Zhang, and I'm also a student at Washington. I want to start by saying I am grateful to have opportunities like the College and the Schools programs available to me. I will be graduating from Washington with 14 credits from the University of Minnesota and 4 credits from St. Paul College. This fall, I also took the Exploring the Teaching Profession course because I was considering being a teacher. We discussed in class current issues facing education today, including equity. I realized that at school, I set parts of my culture aside to blend in and be who my teachers want me to be. Another experience I got from this class was the opportunity to go to an elementary school for my field experience. I did my service learning in a second grade classroom where 97% of the students are Hmong. Growing up, I've always longed to have teachers that look like me. My first day of my field experience, I was automatically able to bond and build a relationship with my students because, like them, I am Hmong. This showed me the importance of having a teacher that looks like you. Another experience I realized how badly St. Paul Public Schools in our state needs diverse teachers like me. I vividly remember having trouble connecting with my teachers because all throughout my elementary and most of my middle school and high school experience, my teachers have been white. I noticed the lack of teachers who look like me, think like me, and the fact that I don't have any teachers I can fully connect with on a cultural level. I think that if St. Paul Public Schools and all other districts were able to recruit more teachers of color, this would be very beneficial to students. So please fully fund all of the program in this bill. As a result of taking this exploration course, I have determined that I definitely want to be a teacher so that I can impact children's lives. My dream is to become an elementary school teacher in St. Paul Public Schools and live and work in the community. That means so much to me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Zhang. Ms. Livingston, you're up next, and then we've got Mr. Jama on deck. You know, opening day for the twins is Thursday, home opener.
Woo!
You got it. Ms. Livingston, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Okay. Chair and members, my name is Tricia Livingston. I am 33 years old, and I am currently enrolled in the Urban Teacher Program at Metropolitan State University. It is the most diverse teacher preparation program and most affordable university in this state. If all goes according to plan, I will be doing my student teaching in the spring of 2020. It has been a bumpy ride to be where I'm at today. I did not attend college right after I graduated high school. I made choices that brought me in a different path, but when I finally found my way to college, when I looked at the options that I could major in, I knew without a doubt that I wanted to be a teacher. I did not have the greatest experiences in school when I was younger, but there were very specific and few teachers that had a strong and positive impact on my experience, and I really want to be that for someone else. Although I have the moral support of my family, they are unfortunately unable to support me financially while I'm in school. I've had to try and pay for it all myself. The struggle of balancing school and work has been very stressful for me. With school being my priority, I haven't been able to work enough to support myself through college and living expenses without loans because scholarships are small. Currently, I have $60,000 in debt, and just last fall, I ran out of financial aid. And what my family is thought to be able to pay, which in reality is nothing, has disqualified me from ever receiving a Pell Grant. My schoolwork has suffered greatly because of the financial stress I'm in right now. I'm starting to lose faith in myself, which breaks my heart. The great state of Minnesota needs more teachers of color and American Indian teachers. Many hopeful teachers of color do not come from situations that allow them to be financially secure during school and especially during their student teaching. While this bill would significantly impact me, I would also like you to think of the hundreds of others who could benefit from it too, because it would not only help just me, it would help many others. Please give your full support to this bill to help people of color and American Indian teachers become the quality teachers that are so needed in the education field of our great state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Livingston. Mr. Chama.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Abdurrazak Chama, and I'm proud to say that I will soon be a licensed ESL teacher. I'm here to speak today as a teacher candidate in Augsburg University East African Student to Teacher East program funded by Collaborative Urban Education Grant. I speak four languages and I can understand three more. I know the value of having strong ESL teachers in our community. I have worked in the Minneapolis Public Schools for over a decade as an associate educator and have formed a strong professional relationship with students to support their success in the school. In spite of the best intentions of the teachers in our schools, who are mostly white and only know one language, I believe that students of color and multilingual students will benefit from having a teachers that look like me. I feel grateful to be part of the EAST program at Expert, and I know my peers also appreciate the scholarships and other support provided to us. Without this financial support and the support of the staff and the faculty and my peers at Expert, I would not be able to afford to become a teacher, and I might not have been as successful as I have been towards completing my licensure program. As the numbers of institutions receiving grants from the Collaborative Urban Education and Greater Minnesota has more than doubled in the past 2 years, but the state funding has remained the same. There's a big need for more funding of this grant program. I know there are other students at Augsburg and other institutions who could also benefit from this program if there was more money available through this program. I'm also excited to know that this bill proposes a $10,000 per year scholarship for teacher candidates before student teaching, and $7,500 during student teacher for teacher candidates of color. I look forward to working in this community as a licensed teacher for many years to come. I ask for your full support of the whole 2019 Increased Teachers of Color Act, including significantly more money for the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color Program. The EAST program at Augsburg University is making a lot of difference in my community, and the program at the other universities are also doing the same. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chama. I trust that you're Ms. Zachary?
Yes.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. On deck, I'm going to get this wrong, Jim Mikulich. I'm a little voice tells me. So, sir, if you're in the room, you come down, and then after that, Ms. Kostahova, and I probably got that wrong too. Ms. Zachary, welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Hello. My name is Kiara Zachary. I am an equity specialist for Robbinsville Area Schools and an elementary teacher candidate in the University of Minnesota's Grow Your Own Teacher program. I am here to speak today in favor of the Increased Teachers of Color Act. I've known since I was a little girl that I wanted to be a teacher. I remember playing teacher to my stuffed animals in my bedroom or teaching my little cousins to read as we were growing up. Moreover, all of the important women in my life were teachers to some degree. My grandmother was a special education teacher with Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Schools for several decades. My mother was an early childhood education teacher and social worker. My aunts are educators and school administrators in Minnesota, North Carolina, Texas, and Arkansas. The passion for teaching is ingrained in my DNA. However, I have faced many barriers in my pursuit of becoming a teacher. One, even with all of these strong women in my family, I lack professional connections with others that look like me in my field. As a single mother, I couldn't afford to complete the required unpaid student teaching, and even though I worked in a school, I found it difficult to schedule and complete practicum hours. Due to all of these circumstances, I discontinued my first graduate program to obtain initial teacher's licensure. It wasn't until I became an equity specialist and began to analyze the root causes of the maintained inequities of student education opportunities that I realized I needed to go back. Every day, I saw students and families that yearned for understanding, representation in their school communities, and in the curriculum from other folks that looked like them. I was emailed about an opportunity to become a part of a cohort program that would come with grant funding from my employing district and other funds from the University of Minnesota. I had to take the opportunity. The opportunity to maintain my current position and further my career in education has become invaluable for not only myself and my family, but also for the families of my students as well. Being in this program exemplifies my true commitment to educational equity and being a part of the change that's necessary. I know how many other people of color would also become a part of the change if they were provided with the same grant and scholarship opportunities for licensure and student teaching that I have been afforded. Thank you for your time, and please approve the proposed funding in the whole Increase Teachers of Color Act to help close opportunity gaps and meet the needs of students and future teachers of color.
Thank you very much, Ms. Zachary. Mr. Mikulich?
Thank you, Chair Dabney, members of the committee. My name is Jim Miklosich, and I'm the principal at Shakopee East Middle School and a member of the Minnesota Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the board, which has given full support to HF 824. In January, Pelsby released the Minnesota Supply-Demand Report, which examined the makeup of the state's teacher workforce. The report found that nearly one-third of Minnesota students were of color, yet non-white teachers make up only 4% of the state teaching workforce. These disparities are significant throughout greater Minnesota, where the percentage of teachers of color does not even reach 1%, despite the fact that the percentage of non-white students exceeds double digits. The Twin Cities metro area has the highest proportion of teachers of color at 7%, falling well short of the 45% of students of color in our metro schools. As a principal, I've seen firsthand the positive impact that recruiting and retaining teachers of color can have on a school community. As principal of Richardson Elementary School in North St. Paul, we had 70% students of color taught by 18 classroom teachers, all of whom were white. After significant work, the school was able to recruit and hire a member of the Hmong community. However, her experience as the only teacher of color on staff was very isolating. Fortunately, other Hmong teachers heard about the impact that this woman was having, applied for, and eventually joined our team. This created a natural affinity group and a more supportive, welcoming, and innovative environment for the school's teachers and staff. The benefits of diversifying the school's staff extended well beyond teacher support. We noticed that students held more pride in our school and were more invested in learning. We saw positive changes in how parents interacted with the school's teachers and administration. In short, we began building a stronger, more positive learning community. This past December, Pelsby voted unanimously to support this bill because we believe it will help diversify the teacher workforce and impact all Minnesota students in a positive way. The board believes and research suggests that this bill's focus on expanding teacher recruitment efforts, providing scholarships to candidates in teacher preparation, and developing stronger teacher retention programs are strategies that will help break down barriers that teachers of colors have faced in pursuing the profession in Minnesota. I, along with all the members of Pelsby, strongly support this bill and ask for your support.
Thank you very much. Dean, I'm going to get it wrong, so I'm just going to say welcome to the committee, but then say Ms. Contreras is next, and after that, Ms. Hernandez. So, Dean, please, welcome to the committee.
Dean Castehova.
Castehova.
You did it right.
Well.
Good morning. My name is Marcela Castehova, and I currently serve as the Dean of the College of Liberal Arts in the School of Education at Hamline University, and I'm here to represent the recipients of the Collaborative Urban Education Program. So that is the University of St. Thomas, Concordia University and Hamline University, and more recently Augsburg, and you have just heard from one of their current students who is just about to be licensed. You have heard a lot about what would be possible if this bill is funded, and I'm here to speak strongly in support of House File H24. My job today is to talk about what has been possible. So initially, the three institutions, the founding institutions, and more recently Augsburg, have been working on increasing the number of teachers of color in the state of Minnesota for 20 years. Between our programs, we have placed about 1,000 students in Minnesota schools in the last years that we've been working on it. We have learned a lot, and we continue to be learning from our work with our students, with whom we work closely. And I will only endorse what you have heard from others today, which is that it is very important to support our future teachers in a multifaceted fashion. One of the things that we learned at Hamline is that it's not only important to provide scholarships for students, though those scholarships are absolutely important, and without them students would never succeed, but it's also important to provide mentorship both throughout the program, but also through the first few years on the job. Ever since we have implemented that program, the retention of our teachers of color in the schools have been 100%. Of course, the teachers that we place in the schools are very highly sought after, and so they have nearly 100% retention rate. At Hamline, that placement rate was 99.5% because one of our students went on maternity leave, which we're okay with. As I said, we are incredibly grateful that this work has been recognized, and we look forward to working with other partners in the state of Minnesota in broadening this work. I think that many institutions should have the opportunity to continue doing this work in the future, and we look forward to expanding the work that we do, either in piloting additional mentorship support programs or working with cohort of administrators of color, because we don't only need to increase the number of teachers, but also administrators. And we have many other ideas which we could implement in the future. We, of course, have some concerns about all of the programs being competitive, because we think it's very important for any program that receives this funding to have it in an ongoing fashion so that students can continue counting on future financial support. But in general, we want to say that we are very proud of this work, and we look forward to collaborating with any and all stakeholders.
Thank you, Dean Castahova. Ms. Contreras?
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Sabrina Tapia Contreras, and I am an elementary school teacher in the Prior Lake Savage School District. I'm not only a teacher of color, but I also serve as the culturally responsive coach for my district as well as across the state. I'm here that you fully support the whole Increased Teachers of Color Act, including the new proposed Inclusive School Act Enhancement Grant Program. These grants will support schools and districts like mine implementing the changes to make our school curriculum and climate more inclusive and respectful for all students and families. I also ask that you fully support the mentoring and retention grants that are included and increase the funding for Teachers Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program. Our district is in a state of emergency in the terms that there are very few teachers of color we have compared to the current student demographics, which have changed rapidly to now include 20% students of color. My role as a culturally responsive coach has allowed me into some important conversations in the district. When I saw that there were no other persons of color being included in important conversations regarding curriculum and mental health, I was concerned and talked to the district administrator about this, as well as the retention rate and general morale of teachers of color. He stated to me that he would love to have a conversation about the data behind the retention rates of teachers of color, but there is none. He said that there were so few teachers of color in our district, he could not give me any conclusions to why there would be teachers who wish to stay or teachers who would wish to leave. Our state must do more to act, support, and retain people of color into teaching to make a difference in the lives of all students. Teaching is one of the most rewarding but challenging jobs in the world. Somebody has to be tenacious enough to take on the crippling student debt with the likelihood of low salary. They also have to find and navigate the few teaching programs designed to support their academic journey and earn the licensure to get hired. For those of us who make it past all of that and gain our own classrooms, we are expected to do more than our peers. We are also not provided adequate mentorship programs and are still not put into leadership positions. This causes the very, very few teachers of color who are in districts across the state to leave. And that also leaves the visual daily reminder of students of color that they too can be successful. Again, I ask you to please support all of the important decisions in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hernandez.
Chair and members, good morning. My name is Roberta Hernandez. I live and teach in Roseville. I'm here to speak about the importance of Section 14 regarding mentoring and retention of effective teachers. In Roseville, I've been fortunate to help create and belong to an affinity group for teachers of color since 2007. Our group has been the space for us to develop relationships to support and encourage each other, especially for teachers that experience the isolation of being the only one in their school. We mentor and support each other as we try to give voice to what happens for our students of color to learn, what needs to happen for them to learn. But too often, we find our voices as teachers of color get dismissed. We support each other dealing with emotional challenges that come as we encounter microaggressions on sometimes a daily basis. Our affinity group has also advocated when other teachers of color are being pushed out of the district, after their third year, even though their evaluations have followed the needed positive path leading toward tenure. Our affinity group has given us a forum to address needed areas of equity in our district. Even while we are often expected to do extra work compared to white teachers in serving the needs of students of color and their families with representing a racial equity lens, such work can be taxing and daunting. Our affinity group has been a space for us to receive much needed differentiated professional development as a safe learning community. We continue our own growth in cultural understanding and issues affecting us as we teach racially diverse students in a white dominant system. In this space, we no longer have to respond and explain our perspectives to educate our white colleagues, but can for a moment focus on our own growth around race equity for ourselves and for our students. When we began a group, we met monthly, which was necessary for our community to build and get to know each other. We needed that time in order to spend in building those relationships. We wrote and received grants to support many of our activities as well. However, as funding has diminished, we have scaled back the number of meetings to meet at least only three times a year, which makes that community harder to sustain. We have meetings during the day, which means we need substitutes paid for as well. We chose that so that teachers with young children or children at home could attend instead of having to find other means of daycare for them. When others in the Twin Cities have heard of our group, they've come to visit to see what it's like to have this kind of affinity group and support. They leave asking for this for themselves. In the past few months, I have been asked to speak with teachers from the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota. They want to know what to do to begin and to create their own affinity groups because the need for this is so strong. The funding for mentorship and retention in this bill would help racially diverse educators in my district and throughout the state remain in the profession rather than leave at higher rates than white teachers. If you fully fund this program, you will create an important system which will lead to the retention of teachers as well as allow them to continue to develop their assets, which would strengthen our service. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 824 as amended? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could Mrs. Livingston please come back up?
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Livingston, thank you for being so open with your personal story. I just wanted to get a few facts right. If I understand it right, you said you're already $60,000 in debt with your student loans?
That is correct. Yes.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Livingston, how much longer do you have to go to, when will you be done with your degree?
Ms. Livingston?
I'll be doing my student teaching in the spring of 2020, so at the end of that, like June of 2020, I'll be done.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Livingston, are you working outside of this right now?
Ms. Livingston?
I serve tables on the weekend at a restaurant in Minnetonka.
Representative Hewitt.
Ms. Livingston, I'm running the numbers here with your only with your $60,000 student loan debt and trying to qualify you for a house once you graduate. I'm a realtor, so I'm looking at what the numbers are here. And I'm astonished on how you're doing. I am just flabbergasted by what you're doing with yourself, and I am so proud of you for continuing down this route. Obviously, we need to go a long way here. What I look at when you're all done, you're still going to be struggling, aren't you?
Ms. Livingston?
Well, I'll be doing the best that I can.
Representative Hewitt, any last question?
I do, and just a statement. When she gets all done with everything without any help at all, she'll have $333 to live off of based on her salary of a first-year teacher. So just something for the committee to know.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Juergens.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who can answer this, but a couple years ago we did away with the last-in, first-out law, and I'm just wondering how that may have impacted teachers of color, teachers that are good teachers that may have lacked the seniority in the past. Has that helped increase the number of teachers of color?
Who wants to take that one?
Okay. Well, I can respond to that a little bit from my own. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just from my own experience, so last in, first out is a seniority route of having to eliminate teachers because of budget cuts. And unfortunately, that's the what has happened over the span of Minnesota's educational system, is that as we continue to underfund our schools, and every spring, teachers, whether they're new or have been there for a while, will receive a pink slip. They're let go. I, for my first 3 years of teaching, I got a pink slip every single spring, and hoping that I would get hired back again. And so while it's not the most perfect way of dealing with the shortage of teachers of color, it certainly is the history of why Minnesota has fewer and fewer teachers of color. And it's another reason why so many, when we talk about a teacher shortage, it's another big reason why we have a teacher shortage, is because without that funding from Minnesota continually, we aren't able to keep good teachers in the classroom. They aren't able to get tenured and build up their salary and their steps and their lanes. And it's just important that we take a good look at that as well. So, yeah, it did have an impact on teachers of color.
Ms. Espinosa, mm-hmm. came forward.
Mr. Chair, member, thank you for your question. I just wanted to address the fact that the bill does address this phenomenon. And you can look at on page 15 that school districts can negotiate additional retention strategies or protection from layoffs in the beginning years for particular educators of color and American Indian teachers. We've discussed this over the last 2.5 years with members of the committee, and this was heard in policy, but just wanted to point out that this does address.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to remind people, too, over 50% of the districts in the state already have different retention strategies negotiated in their contract, so they're already moving towards that.
Representative Edelson, last question.
Thank you, Chair. I want to I think back on this bill, and I'm so supportive, but in 1954, an important decision was made, Brown versus Board of Education. And one of the things that did not happen with that decision is when we integrated our schools, we did not integrate teachers within that. So there were African-American teachers. There were teachers of color, but you start looking at what happens when we have to, you know, we have let this happen for so long that we haven't tried to correct what happened here, and I'm thank you for bringing this bill. We're righting a wrong that should have been righted a long time ago.
Representative Kunesh-Badin, any closing comments?
May I ask one more person to come down and speak as a closing comment?
It's either your closing comment or your testifier's closing comment.
All right. Well, then I will just close with this request that we fully fund this bill and move towards including all of our schools in that opportunity to have teachers of color in front of all of our students. So thank you very much this morning.
Thank you very much. With that, Representative Kunesh-Badin renews her motion that House File 824, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a future division report. Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Badin. Representative Pryor, we've got a little parliamentary maneuvering going on here. Mm-hmm. You're kind. So, members into the public, there will not be any testimony on House File 2195. We're moving it on, but we need to do a couple of things to make that happen. So, Representative Pryor, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move the adoption of the division report on House File 2195?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make that motion.
Any discussion? Members, this is a motion that requires a vote. It's not one we've done I think often or before in this committee. So any discussion to the prior motion to adopt the division report on House File 2195? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Pryor, would you now like to make a motion to move House File 2195 to be before the committee with a recommendation it be referred to Ways and Means, with a further recommendation that it be moved to the Committee on Judiciary?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make that motion.
Thank you very much. That was a mouthful. Could you please briefly explain the bill for the committee?
Yes, this is a bill that is relating to early childhood, and it has a number of provisions that are going to help with the coordination of the various programs that we have serving children. But there is a section of it that's talking about data, and we would like to be have it heard in front of the Judiciary Committee.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify either for or against House File 2195? Seeing none, Representative Erickson, member discussion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it also your intention to recommend that this be referred to government operations, since there is a task force in it?
Okay. Representative Pryor, do you want to respond to that?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We are going to have an amendment that we'll introduce in Judiciary and get it done there, because it was not the intent to create a task force, but it's a group that will do this work without actually being a task force. We'll have it up in front of Judiciary with that amendment.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Pryor, are you planning to have a working group? Is that what you're converting it to instead of a task force?
Representative Pryor, we're delving into language.
Yes, and because I'm still learning the language of legislators, I'm not that fluent yet. I will have a testifier that will help me with that answer.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning.
And proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Strong-Belisle, representing Closed Gaps by Five. Thank you for the time this morning. Just to clarify the language, and we have the amendment ready to go for Judiciary, we'll change this to a report. There is some outreach being done by MDE through the preschool development grant, and so this will we envision this becoming part of that effort. So it will be a report only, not a working group or a task force.
And just a reminder to members, and you can correct me, the preschool development grant was a federal grant that the department received in December-ish for about $4.7 million, $4.7 million, I believe. Close enough?
Close enough, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering why Representative Pryor wouldn't have offered that amendment in this committee, since it would deal with education.
Representative Pryor?
I didn't have it ready. I apologize.
Mm-hmm. Representative Erickson. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think we need to follow our rules.
Any other member questions? Representative Pryor, any closing comment?
No. Appreciate the support.
All right. With that, Representative Pryor renews her motion that House File 2195 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, with a further recommendation that it be referred from there to the Committee on the Judiciary. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Wasilewicz. Representative, Representative Richardson, would you like to move House File 566 be before the committee for possible inclusion in a future division report?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Representative Wasilewicz, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony on House File 566.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Amy Wasilewicz. And House File 566 requires school districts to establish safety assessment teams and provides duties to the teams and a description of kind of what their role is. And the bill also appropriates money for safety assessment grants for schools to use to help train folks and to help get things set up. And with me today, I have a testifier, Cottage Grove Police Captain Randy McAllister, to speak to the idea of school safety assessment teams and then a little bit to the bill as well.
Thank you very much, Representative Wasilewicz. Captain McAllister, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Randy McAllister. I'm a Deputy Director of Public Safety for Cottage Grove Police Department, and I'm also the Minnesota Chair of the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals and a Certified Threat Manager. So I come to you today to in support of House File 566, which is a school assessment safety assessment bill. Just by way of history, back in 1999, the U.S. experienced a watershed moment in terms of school safety and violence, and that was the Columbine shooting. After that, the U.S. Department of Education and the U.S. Secret Service undertook a study, a multi-year study, to look at the past history of school shootings in America and try to really come up with some sort of operational factors, you know, things that they could discover about the violence and that school districts could immediately implement to prevent such acts of violence in the future. After they concluded their study, they published it in 2002. And with that, this idea of threat assessment or school safety assessment team came to the forefront, and it's been a recommended best practice since 2002. Unfortunately, what we found is that very few school districts have implemented sort of a best practice model threat assessment program or team, despite the fact that it's recommended by the U.S. Department of Education and many, many other organizations. So just among some of the key findings that the Safe School study found, that number one, the incidents at school were suddenly were rarely sudden or impulsive attacks. In fact, they were typically planned out over days, weeks, or months, in some cases years. Prior to most incidents, other people knew about the attacker's idea and or plan to attack. Most attackers did not threaten their targets directly prior to making the attack. There is no accurate or useful profile of students who engage in target violence attacks. Most attackers engage in some behavior prior to the incident that caused others concern or indicated a need for help. Oftentimes there are cries for help before these things happen. Most attackers had difficulty coping with significant losses or personal failures. Most attackers had access to and had used weapons prior to the attack. In most cases, other students were involved in some capacity, and they actually found that in a significant number of these, they're actually responsible adults who had some indications of what was going on. And despite prompt law enforcement responses, most shooting incidents were stopped by means other than law enforcement intervention. So that's kind of where we started with this whole movement. So the Secret Service found that some people make threats, but they don't pose a threat, and then some people who pose a threat don't make a threat. And that's really where threat assessment lives. We're trying to determine which threats or threatening behaviors do we really need to be concerned about. Also in their study, they found that 95% of school shooters are current students at that school, and 5%, the other 5% are former students, recently former students. And this really speaks to the approaches we've been taking. Last year, after the tragedy in Florida, where we had 17 dead and 17 injured, and I think if you count the two recent suicides, you can increase the victims in that case. After that attack, the state of Minnesota asked folks to come up with ideas for preventing something similar in Minnesota. Unfortunately, I think the approach we took was to allocate $25 million for physical security measurements or measures. But physical security, door locks, cameras, those kinds of things are not going to stop most of these school shootings because they're current students. The shooters are, and they're supposed to be there. They can get their weapons in if they want to. So what we need is a more proactive approach that identifies people of concern on a pathway to violence long before they actually get to that point of going through the doors. So that's kind of where we're at. The FBI recently impaneled a bunch of experts from around the country in 2015, and they found that by far the most valuable prevention strategy identified for preventing targeted attacks, which includes the shootings, the kind of mass shootings we see, is the threat management team. So that's an important thing that I'm certainly committed to. Higher education has embraced it. Unfortunately, K-12 hasn't so much in my experience. Certainly there are exceptions, and some districts have good programs, but they're not very uniform, and typically they lack any sort of robust training in best practices and standards. So at its core, threat assessment attempts to intervene with people on a path to violence and gets them back on a healthy path. We know from research that violence doesn't happen out of the blue. Planning for violent attacks typically takes, again, days, weeks, or months. Acts of targeted violence are committed by people who have been overwhelmed in their lives by multiple stressors. Threat assessment helps identify those people under stress, identify their stressors and destabilizers, and get them help. Good threat assessment programs also identify ways to improve the overall school culture so that the school culture itself is not one of those stressors. And one of the things we talk a lot about is bullying, and a good threat assessment program addresses anti-bullying measures as well as mental health type programs. But school violence doesn't just include your mass shootings. Those are relatively rare, but obviously grab the attention in the headlines. Typically, we see lots of lesser forms of violence in schools, which would include the serious bullying or fear for safety, repeated harassment and stalking. A lot of teen dating violence and sexual assaults happens and starts in high schools and junior highs, and then sort of repeated fighting or threatening behaviors towards others. So threat assessment as a model can be used to address all of these kinds of violence, not just your shootings, but all the lesser stuff too. So the role of the threat assessment team is to promote this culture of safe schools. We avoid zero tolerance policies in the world of threat assessment because they don't work. They stigmatize kids. They actually punish kids who had no intention of acting out violently. But on the flip side, you have to take every threat seriously and investigate it. So just to address some quick misperceptions about it that come up frequently, it's not a profile. Threat assessment does not profile students. Profiles look at a crime scene, for instance, after the fact, try to look at the evidence and try to tell you who did it. Threat assessment is behavior driven. We look at behaviors identified in the research. It's not a crisis management team. Crisis management teams are reactive generally, and they react after the fact to something that happens in sort of an emergency management type setting. Litigation, it actually decreases litigation or the risk of being sued because it's the best practice again. And again, just to sum up, finally, it's supported as a best practice by multiple organizations in the country, the National Association of School Psychologists, FBI, American Psychological Association, and finally the U.S. Department of Education. So I just strongly encourage this body to consider this bill. It's an important bill. Again, it would be much cheaper than $25 million that's not actually going to address the problem that the money was set aside for.
Thank you, Captain. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 566? Seeing none. Representative DeMuth, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wazelwick, thank you for bringing this forward. I served to the testifier, too. I served on the Ricori School Board for 11 years. I also have four children that have graduated from Ricori, and I think I'm sitting in a little bit different spot than the rest of our committee right now. As a community member, as a parent, and this topic is very important to all Minnesota schools, and especially back in my district, so thank you. One question that I have, though, in an effort to keep our students safe, our teachers safe, our administration safe, are there consequences for students that have filed false reports on fellow students to cause a school safety assessment? Are there any consequences for that?
Thank you, Representative DeMuth. Captain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not that I'm aware of in the bill. Obviously, there's certain things you could do through the legal system, possibly if there's a false report of a crime, those kinds of things, but not through the bill itself.
Okay.
Representative DeMuth?
Thank you.
All right. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Captain, a real quick question here. And what I've noticed, I come from the public service, public safety background, too. And one of the things I've started to notice with this is the opportunity for law enforcement off-duty officers. What is the qualification of the officer that would be doing a safety assessment?
Captain McAllister.
Mr. Chair and committee member, typically the person that would be on a threat assessment team in terms of the law enforcement partner would be your school resource officer. The team has to get trained in the whole process, not just individuals. So As you know, law enforcement doesn't typically receive threat assessment training in our academies or skills programs. So it would be additional training, and that's one of the things that is lacking in many districts that on paper have threat assessment teams. They don't actually have formal training for all the members that's based on a national best practice scenario. So.
Representative Hewitt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and before I ask my question, I want to thank Representative Wasluck for picking this bill up. It's a good bill. I know we heard this in committee last year. I believe Representative Frankie carried it, and I appreciate you bringing this forward. It did end up in our final legislation, but unfortunately got vetoed in the final omnibus bill. So appreciate you picking this up and continuing the work. My question has to do with the safety assessment report. Do parents and students have a chance to review that report and or a chance to challenge it if they feel it's wrong? Then, curious.
Representative Wasluwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bennett. I believe that as a piece of, I don't know if the student is specifically named in here, but this, the parents certainly would have an opportunity to see the report.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Wasluck. So could they challenge that report, or is it, you know, written in stone forever, or how does that work?
Representative Wasluck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bennett, I'm not sure that that specific language is in the bill, but I think that there would certainly, I think, within the school district be an opportunity to have a conversation if there are concerns with the report.
Representative Bennett. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wasluwick. I'm looking at Subdivision 5 on redisclosure and learned that in the Senate they sent it to Judiciary. So I'm wondering, is it your intention to make sure that what's cited in Subdivision 5 on page 3 will be looked at by those who understand data practices and the protection of it?
Representative Wasluwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Erickson, for the question. That is not my intent, but if that's something that we feel like needs to be done, we can certainly consider that.
Perhaps a chat with the chair of the mm-hmm. Judiciary Committee is in order.
Mr. Chair, may I
address Captain that? McAllister.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That also is addressed under FERPA, the Federal or Family Education Rights Protection Act, specifically addresses threat assessment and the sharing information within the team. Also, it in relation to Subdivision 5, it explicitly states that you can't share the information from a threat assessment process outside the team. So if you're a school resource officer, for instance, assigned to the team, you cannot go back to your police department and share that information unless there's some sort of emergency exception.
Representative Erickson?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Captain, it is our process around here, though, you know, to make sure that every committee that has jurisdiction examines the language to ensure that it is the language that will be of protection of data. So I think it's something that should be considered. But thank you for your detail. Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wasluwick, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to chat with you before about this. I know when it was in ed policy, there were still some concerns by NAMI and some of the language. And I see Ms. Abner Holder in the audience. I didn't know if there was still some concerns.
Representative Wasluwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Joachim. We did have a conversation, and we are, if this bill is included in the omnibus bill, we're going to be including some language changes.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Captain McAllister, you indicated that one of the uses of threat assessment teams was in situations with bullying, and while bullying is a significant area of concern, it's usually a disciplinary matter, and I think there would be many people uncomfortable with police engagement in school discipline. Why would a police officer be involved in dealing with incidents of bullying that did not rise to a criminal complaint of assault or something of the sort?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. The short answer is it's not the law enforcement agency that's dealing with bullying in the context of threat assessment. It's the threat assessment team that possibly could be. Typically, there's got to be some sort of threat or threatening behavior for it to rise to the level of a sort of a threat assessment process. And the SRO, the school resource officer on that team, is just one member. And typically they don't get involved in school. They aren't in charge of the school disciplinary process. That would be handled by the school folks on the team itself. Just as an example, Virginia has this statewide law. It's been in place since 2015 or 2013. And they found that 70% of the complaints of threats or threatening behaviors are found to be what they call transient. So they're determined not to be significant, and it doesn't go any further than a screening process. 30% are found to have something to them, so that the team needs to investigate it. But again, it's the team, and it's generally the folks from the educational facility that would be involved in any discipline issues.
Thank you very much. Representative Wazlowick, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just acknowledging kind of the testimony that we heard today and the need for these sorts of teams. I work in school-based childcare and have certainly seen not anything that would rise to this level, but certainly seen the bullying going on. I think it's important that we have systems and policies in place that will help solve some of these problems and prevent some of these things from happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, Representative Richardson renews her motion that House File 566 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future division report. Thank you very much. Representative Erdahl. Representative Daniels, would you like to move that House File 16 be before the committee to lay over for possible inclusion in a future division report?
I so move, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Daniels. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And House File 16 deals with the program we have for small school revenue. Our smaller Minnesota schools face many unique challenges. One, they often don't have the property values that aid many of the larger schools. For fiscal year 2019, small schools revenue totals $16.4 million and goes to Minnesota's 160 smallest school districts. Those are the population under 960. This would change it to $31 million, and 216 of this would be the small school category.
Thank you very much.
I could have said more,
but I'm trying to be helpful. Brevity is a value. Dr. Nolan, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Fred Nolan, Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Really appreciate our Representative Erdahl for bringing this bill, and for Mr. Strom for the fine summary. This bill does three things. The most important is that below 480 students right now, the dollars per the whole school district go down. The dollars per kid go up, but when you have very few students, and there are 72 school districts below 480 students total in the district, that's 21,000 students. There's only five districts that are larger than that. And so those districts, as they get smaller, they get less revenue. It also shifts that medium number to 750. There's a good reason for that. That captures 125 districts smaller than 750 with 54,000 students. But in interest of brevity, I'm going to turn it over to Matt Schultz, Superintendent Lanesboro, who has very few students.
Superintendent Schultz, welcome to the committee. Did you bike here this morning?
I could have from Lanesboro, yeah.
Yes, you could have. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Yeah, my name is Matt Schultz. I'm the superintendent at Lanesboro Public Schools. I'm here to talk about HF16. We're a very small school in southeastern Minnesota. We have approximately 360 actual bodies in the building. We've got our APU, I think it's around 380. We also have a full slate of daycare in our building, preschool. You name it, for a small community, we have it. We've had a small, steady increase in enrollment over the last 3 years. And obviously, our school is the center of our community. We do everything we can to make sure students leave with a high-quality education. 3 years ago, we had a strategic plan session. We had over 45 people attend that strategic planning session. And in our city of 700, that was a wonderful number. All told, I think we had over 200 people involved in setting up our strategic plan. So we truly do care about our school in Lanesboro. 85% of our students go on to a four-year institution. Our ACT scores are around 2 points higher than any of the school districts around us. So as you can tell, we value our education. Our community is very independent, and we're very proud, and over the last 40 years, we've done everything that we can to try to keep our tax burden low on our taxpayers. Obviously, yesterday, our egg tax bills got in our farmers' hands, so I had some calls and some discussions yesterday, which is wonderful, but they truly do care about our school. Small schools revenue allows us to continue offering the quality programming that a rural community needs. We have a full-time egg teacher. Keep in mind, we have about 120 students, grades 9 through 12. We have a full-time egg teacher, a full-time industrial tech teacher, a full-time art teacher, full-time band instructor, full-time choir instructor, a full-time business teacher, and a full-time Spanish teacher. If you looked at Lanesboro schools, you'd see we might be a little bit unique. Our students start Spanish in fifth grade and work all the way up through 12th grade. They have an opportunity for art just about every day. We have physical education every day for all of our students. So we do what we can. With that said, expenses that we have no control over are outpacing our revenue. So, for example, our electric bills. We don't control that right now. I pay 14.5 cents per kilowatt hour, which is about double what it was 10 years ago. Our funding for small schools hasn't kept pace with things like that. Cost of buses has increased over the last 5 years. Our food dollars have increased over the last 5 years. Even our water bills have outpaced what our increases in state revenue have been. This bill would add $111,000 to our general fund, and while that seems, if you're in a school district with 5,000 students, $111,000 doesn't seem like much, but for us that's two full-time teachers. So it really has a significant impact on what we can offer our community in Lanesboro. Small schools in Minnesota, it doesn't take long from Lanesboro to see what can happen to a community that doesn't keep its small school. Just right around us, we have communities like Wyckoff, Peterson, Canton, Altura. There's communities within a half an hour of Lanesboro that no longer have their schools. And it's an important part of rural Minnesota, so this bill would have a significant impact in keeping what we have in rural Minnesota and making sure that all of our students have an opportunity to go on and be successful. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 16? Seeing none. Representative Erdahl, closing comments.
Well, thank you. I hope that this bill can be, I'm sure will be given due consideration by the committee. It really is an important issue. It's very important for a lot of schools in greater Minnesota particularly, and appreciate your hearing the bill. And I also am sure that in Lanesboro, though he didn't mention it, they do have civics. Thank you.
Good to know. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. With that, Representative Daniels renews his motion that House File 16 be laid over for possible inclusion in a division report. And, Superintendent, if energy costs are a concern, you might want to stick around for the last bill here. thank you for coming today. Representative Christensen. Representative Katiza, would you?
Yes.
Would you like to move that House File 1148 be before the committee for possible inclusion in a future division report?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon. Representative Christensen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I will start. I'm here for this bill has gone through the Energy Policy and Finance Committee already, so now this is the last stop of the bill. Schools in Minnesota spend, the prior testifier actually gave me a good feed in here. So schools in Minnesota spend $200 million a year on electricity. And in my school district, the energy bills are second only to personnel, only to hiring staff and teachers. Many schools cannot afford to make an initial investment to initiate good conservation projects. The payback is 3 years if they would change to efficient lighting and 15 years for upgraded HVAC systems. Money-strapped schools would benefit from upfront assistance to invest in energy efficiency and cost savings. A typical Minnesota elementary school spends $60,000 per year on energy costs. A high school spends $130,000 a year. If 20% of those costs are lighting and those costs are reduced by 50%, an average elementary school would save $6,000 per year. HF 1148 creates a revolving loan fund to provide low-cost funds to school districts that they can use to make energy conservation investments to lower energy costs. The loans will be made below market rate of interest for terms up to 15 years. In 2020, $8 million is appropriated from the Renewable Energy Fund to assist school districts in the Xcel territory and $8 million from the General Fund for districts outside of the Xcel area. The Commerce Commissioner will actually manage the program. I'd also like to add, the savings would go to districts, but the savings, as we know, will also go to taxpayers because we as taxpayers are paying those energy bills too. So I'd like to introduce Jamie Fitzke, and she will tell you more. Thank
Great.
You.
Ms. Fitzke, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dabney, Representative Christensen, and members of the Education Committee. I'm Jamie Fitzke, speaking on behalf of the Center for Energy and Environment. Our mission is to promote energy efficiency to strengthen the economy while improving the environment. We have extensive expertise in energy efficiency and in providing schools with energy analysis and efficiency recommendations. CEE supports this bill, as it would provide a financial tool for districts to implement energy efficiency measures. Typically, I'd launch into all the economic reasons to support efficiency, though Representative Christensen has done an excellent job highlighting those benefits. Instead, I'll take a moment to highlight the benefits students will receive. A good learning environment improves student engagement. Light levels, designed for how classrooms are currently used, to read whiteboards and computer screens, not chalkboards. Enabling students to see better reduces eye fatigue and improves concentration. Research from Lawrence Berkeley National Labs finds student health is affected by HVAC systems and indoor air quality. A high-performing system can limit the presence of air toxins and mold. And as Representative Christensen spoke to, the economics makes sense. Schools can reduce their lighting costs by up to 50%, HVAC costs up to 40%, saving money while having higher quality learning spaces. With more than 3,000 school buildings in Minnesota, the savings from wasted energy adds up. So why aren't all schools implementing energy efficiency? Some schools lack information, but more often than not, the cost of implementing energy efficiency improvements are the barrier, as resources are finite for public schools. Some more fortunate school districts are able to access capital improvement or health and safety funds to make these improvements. Other school districts attempt to make incremental piecemeal improvements as systems fail. Though many school districts just don't have the resources to make any changes. I commend the schools who have made energy efficiency improvements. This bill provides schools across the state of Minnesota the same opportunity. Thank you for allowing me to speak in favor of this bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fitzke. I've misplaced my agenda. Sir, welcome to the committee.
No problem. My name is Matt Stupnik, and my company is Cedar Creek Energy. We are a 12-year-old electrical and general contractor, and we're located in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. We work with the Center for Energy and Environment extensively on energy efficiency projects for private and public institutions, nonprofits, so on and so forth. So what we do is we work with them, and we implement the project. What we see with the school districts and schools in particular is that you have definitely the haves and the have-nots. We know that the energy efficiency is going to save money right off the bat by lowering the utility costs, which lowers, you know, everybody's the overall rate, and then, of course, maintenance costs, right? So the maintenance costs right now are also very high because a lot of these schools, like Jamie said, have to piecemeal their stuff together. So if they can come through and do a full-bodied energy efficiency set, it would save quite a bit of money. What we find is that in a lot of areas outstate and in non-Xcel energy territory, it is incredibly difficult because there's no funding. We have to get, even for the projects in-state, inside of Xcel, in a large school district, we have to put a lot of creative financing together. If there was a pool for schools to just tap into, it would just keep everybody's costs lower. So that's why I would support the bill, and our company would. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 1148? Seeing none, Representative Detmer, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could be the test from the for the testifier or the author. Now we're looking at two buckets of money here. We have $8 million from the general fund and $8 million from the state renewable development account. When it comes back to paying back these loans, which, from what account does the school district have to pay back these loans? And would these projects be qualified for any revenue projects that rely on the local levies?
Representative Christensen, Ms. Fitzke, can you help with that, please?
Thank you, Chair, Representative. And I didn't quite catch the last part of your question, but the first part would be that the schools would, through their repayments, it would go to the pool that they had borrowed from initially.
Okay. Representative Detmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the last part of the question, would these projects qualify for any revenue programs that rely on, in part, of the local levies?
Ms. Fitzke?
Chair, Representative, I'd have to check on that and get back to you. From my perspective, I would think that if a project qualifies for energy efficiency, which would be this would be through the Department of Commerce, that any additional resources would be welcomed. But this would be at least one source available for them. But I can get back to you on the levies.
Representative Detmer, let's ask Mr. Strom as well to help clarify your question. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, the school district can use some of its general fund money to repay that, and some of those general fund monies are from local levy sources. I'm not aware that this would increase any of those levies by itself, but for example, if the school district used its operating referendum to pay back part of the loan, it could do that because that's an undesignated revenue source, but it wouldn't increase the amount of operating referendum that the district asks for.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is a good piece of legislation. Most schools are looking at ways that they can cut costs on their energy bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Christensen, on line 1.18, would you tell us why you're specifically defining school district to mean independent or special? You might be referring to Minneapolis as a special. I'm not sure about is there a reason that we define district differently from what we typically do in statute?
Representative Christensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I have to get back to you on that. I have to understand the definition myself before I respond.
Representative Christensen, perhaps let's throw this one to Mr. Strom as
yes,
well.
Thank you,
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, there are three kinds of school districts in Minnesota. Almost all are independent school districts. Minneapolis and South St. Paul are the two special districts. And then there are two common districts, Franconia and Princeburg, and neither of those districts has buildings. So my guess is the definition here was for those that actually had facilities.
Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And Representative Christensen, I also was looking at 123B.65, our energy efficiency projects legislation. Would this project that you're recommending in 1148 be subject to this 123B.65?
Representative Erickson, where are you seeing the reference to 123B.65?
It's bill? Not in the bill.
Ah,
I'm just
I'll stop
referencing a statute that we have and wondering if this proposal in 1148 would be subject to that.
Representative Christensen, Ms. Fitzke, Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, Minnesota statute says a provision in 123B.65 called the Energy Efficiency Projects
yes.
provision. And what that authorizes schools to do is enter into certain energy efficiency contracts with essentially energy system providers and allows the payback from those energy efficiency activities to go directly to the provider. So essentially what that's doing is allowing a way around the contracting procedures so that if a particular system came in and said, or a company came in and said, we'll manage your heating and cooling system for you. You contract with an amount to pay that. They'll pay the bills, and then they would make the energy improvements themselves. So it's often with a third-party energy manager. In the old days, companies like Johnson Controls were the ones that often entered into these contracts. There are other companies, Honeywell and others, that did work like this as well. But that's the history of 123B65, and it generally has to do with the third party being involved in managing the facility's energy use.
Representative Erickson?
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Christensen, would you clarify for us though, whether or not this proposal you're bringing forth would be subject to this as well, just because this is a, as Mr. Strom pointed out, energy efficiency project as well, and that two might have to be linked together, I would think, or could be.
Ms. Fitzke, can you help out with that?
Sure. Chair, Representative, we believe that they could be linked. This would be a way to finance those types of projects.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, Mr. the committee, we see a lot of different types of third-party financing throughout, and that's what makes it creative to the sense that a lot of schools can't even get it done. So if there's just a general fund that the schools can tap into on top of maybe the more creative solutions, it should be maybe a two-part solution, because you're still going to see third parties want to potentially own solar arrays and whatnot on these buildings. So I wouldn't necessarily look at it as an either-or. I think by having a pool, it allows the schools that don't necessarily want a third party to own it, because if a third party owns it, then it costs more money, right? So it seems to make sense to do that. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Christensen, any closing comments?
No, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for considering the bill. I think schools could use a little break, and I think this is a good bill for it. So thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Representative Katiza Woodton has left.
Can she renew her motion when she isn't here?
The chair renews Representative Katiza Witoon's motion that House File 1148 be laid over for possible inclusion in future division report. Representative Christensen testifiers, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Reminder again, members, we are meeting both tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday evenings, as well as our daytime slots. Lots of conversation ahead of us. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.